laws so upon people. I know you have your favorite version, but there I've been in congregations where you have to use their version or you can't be right with God. And what we do is, look at usually it's the King James, no offense,
chapter 10, verse 23, my mother's 25.
But we got this big King James, and you got to carry that on your journey.
And it's a burden because he says, "Let us
in verse 23, let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering. For he who promised is faithful.
How many communion cups
and let us consider how to stimulate one another to love
and
good deeds.
You can only have one
not forsaking our own assembling together, as is the habit of some, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you see the day drawing near."
So some of them are not even coming to the assembly any longer.
Jesus said, "Come unto me, all who are weary and heavy laden."
They have neglected their salvation.
Take my yoke upon you.
One of the first indications that your faith is wavering is
meek and
your lack of attendance.
And you shall find rest for your
soul. Of God.
For my yoke is
you're just losing interest.
In other words,
and so he's warning them about that.
Now go to chapter 5.
There's some other indicators
of
what's going on with these folks and why the writer writes this letter. Drop down to verse 11. And he says, concerning him, and there the him is a reference to Melchizedek that he's going to talk about. He introduces him here, but he doesn't talk about him for another chapter or two. He says, concerning him, we have much to say, and it is hard to explain since you have become dull
that we need to encourage one another.
In some versions, as long as it is translated as sluggish, you become sluggish.
And so what we need,
you're weary. You're not learning anything.
And then he goes on to say in verse 12,
for though by this time,
one another,
in other words, you've been Christians for some time,
and so sometimes
this time you ought to be teaching
across some rough territory.
But you have need again,
and somebody ahead of us on the journey
elementary, and they see me struggling
with oracles of God,
something along
and you've come to need milk,
and not
they turn back and look at me and they say, "Guy,
what's the matter with these
people? You're struggling
with that little problem."
You know, I've been over that.
They've had plenty of time.
The writer says, by this time,
let me give you a hand over there. Let me show you how grown
in their knowledge and understanding of the Lord or His word.
Further along,
they are sluggish. They're dull of hearing
spiritually. They're not tuned in
the trail after me,
and they're struggling with something.
And so they're
losing their faith.
They're wavering
and
they're falling away.
They're drifting away.
And so I help my fellow.
Some have already appeared.
Those ahead on the trail are helping me.
They just turned their back on
Jesus. And at the end of this long line of pilgrims is the trail blazing.
They're not doing the things that they ought to be doing.
And so the writer hears about this.
And he writes this letter
to
those that remain because he knows they're on the verge of quitting
as well.
And he's trying to encourage them.
It's a word.
What a great life it is to be a Christian.
He's trying to get them to hold on.
And who we really are.
Thank you for your kind attention.
I think Hebrews is a great letter for us whenever we become
weary of it all.
Whenever it's difficult for us to live the Christian life. And so we might ask the question, why is it that these people are drifting away? Why are they losing their faith? Well, let's go to chapter 10, and we get some indication, I think, here in chapter 10 of what's going on in their lives. Look at verse 32, and we'll read a few verses here of chapter 10. He says, but remember the former days when, after being enlightened, and that's just a way of saying you became a Christian, you were enlightened about truth, and you obeyed the gospel, you became a Christian. He says, when that happened, you endured a great conflict of sufferings. And then he enumerates some things that they had been through in the past, partly by being made a public spectacle through reproaches and tribulations, and partly by becoming sharers with those who were so treated. So they're persecuted. They were persecuted when they first became Christians, but they didn't mind that because they were committed to the Lord, and they endured all of that. Verse 34 says that you showed sympathy to the prisoners. That's people who were actually arrested because of their faith in the Lord. And you accepted joyfully the seizure of your property. Can you imagine that? In the first century, you could actually have people come in, sometimes it was the government, and take over all of your possessions simply because you named the name of Christ. Well, they endured all of that, knowing, he says, that you have for yourself a better possession and an abiding one. So he's asking them to remember those former days when they were dedicated to the Lord and they were willing to even allow their property be taken from them. And then in verse 35, he says, therefore, do not throw away your confidence, which has a great reward. For you have need of endurance, that when you have done the will of God, you may receive what was promised. He's warning them here, don't throw all of that away where you once were. He knows they're on the verge of just saying, I'm done with this Christianity thing. So obviously they are being persecuted, and apparently the persecution has gone on, and they've become weary of it all. And he talks about their persecution in other passages as well. And so they're about to just say, we've had it up to here. And some of their fellow Christians have already quit. They're not even coming to church. Have you ever noticed that when people start bailing on you, it discourages you? And so here are people that are very discouraged. And they're about to just throw it all away because they need some kind of relief from all of the weariness. They're not growing spiritually. Their faith is no longer strong. So what do you write to a people in that kind of circumstance? Well, I want you to go to chapter 12 because I think we have here a great exhortation that's helpful in our understanding who we are as Christians and what our responsibility is as Christians. Let's just look at the first three verses very quickly. I want to focus on verse 2, but let's read the first two verses, that is. He says, therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses. Now you can just stop there. What's this cloud of witnesses? Well, if you've read Hebrews, you know that chapter 11 is that great roll call of faith heroes. And in chapter 11, you have so many that are listed of Old Testament times that were very faithful to the Lord. And he brings those up as examples for these people. And he shows how these people walked and lived their lives by faith in God. And he shows how they endured such terrible consequences of their faith, all of the persecution that they had to endure. And so he presents this image that there's this cloud of witnesses. These are people who have finished their course. It's sort of like running a race. And now that they have crossed the finish line themselves, Moses and Noah and Abraham and Rebecca and Rachel and all of those great people of faith, they're now sitting up there in the stadium, in the stands, and they're watching and witnessing your leg of the race. And they're there to encourage you. If you're a preacher and you struggle with a congregation, you have just to look up there in the stands and see, oh, there's Moses. He had a little trouble, didn't he, with his congregation of about 3.5 million people. And did he give up? No, he didn't. So why should I give up? Have you lost a child? Has life gotten hard on you? Why don't you look up there in the stadium and see this great cloud of witnesses? There are some women there that have been through exactly what you've been through. There are some men there that know exactly what you're going through. And they never gave up. They completed their race, and now they're there to encourage you to keep on keeping on. And so there's this great cloud of witnesses surrounding us. And so he says, let us also, like they, lay aside every encumbrance, whatever might hinder you from completing the race, crossing the finish line, and the sin which so easily entangles us. It's like having these fetters on your feet and they cause you to stumble. That's what sin does. Sin can knock you down, and if you stay down and you don't finish the race, then you're lost, aren't you? And so he's concerned that that's what's happening to them. And so he says, you need to get rid of all of that, the sin that entangles us, and run with endurance. Endurance is that perseverance word, that keep on keeping on. This is a marathon. It's not a sprint. And so you have to have endurance for every inch or every mile of the way if you're going to cross the finish line and be successful and enter into that hope that God has given us. So run with endurance the race that is set before us. It's sort of like all of these great people up in the stands have run their leg of the race, and they've handed the baton off to us who are Christians, and it's now up to us to complete our leg of the race. And we've got to run with endurance all the way to the finish line, to the day in which the Lord comes or the Lord calls us home. Now in verse 2, here's what I really want to get to. All of that was introduction. How many hours do I have? Oh. Some of you are paying attention. You're saying, hours? He's going to talk hours? Look at verse 2. Fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith. Now that word fixing is an interesting term. It literally means to look away from to. That's what it means. And it's sort of like my old high school track coach who said, Orbison, when you're running out there, I don't want you looking up into the stands to see what your girlfriend is doing. I don't want you to look up there and see if she's sitting with your rival or whatever. I don't want that. And I don't want you turning around looking behind you to see what those other runners are doing. I want you to fix your eyes on the goal line. You don't need to be distracted by anything. Well, I didn't have any problem with that because I didn't have a girlfriend at the time. And whenever I ran a race, I could see all the runners. They were in front of me. And so I had no problem with the distractions at all. But he's really saying what the Hebrew writer is saying. There's a goal that you're trying to reach. But here he says, you fix your eyes on Jesus. Now, there are a number of things that are answered in Hebrews about Jesus. And the writer really paints a beautiful picture of Jesus, because that's the problem with these people. They don't understand who Jesus is. When you come to really know who Christ is, you will never turn your back on him. And yet they are entertaining ideas of just completely giving up on Christ. It's because they don't have a clear picture of who he is. And so Hebrews answers three important questions. Number one, who is Jesus? Number two, where is Jesus? And number three is, what is he doing now? And you find that throughout the letter. But who is Jesus? Well, he begins right off the bat in chapter 1 to explain to us who Jesus actually is. Listen to chapter 1, the first few verses here. Well, the first three. God, he says, after he spoke long ago to the fathers in the prophets in many portions and in many ways. There's the Old Testament, God speaking to his people through the prophets. In these last days, in other words, we live in the last period of time. Did you know that? The world or time can be divided into three great eras or dispensations of time. The first was the patriarchal age, where God spoke directly to the fathers, Abraham, to Adam, to Jacob, all of the fathers. And then that second great period of time is the Mosaic Age, the age of the law, where God spoke to his people through the law of Moses. But in these last days, here's the last period of time, when the age of Christianity is done, God's done with this world. We live in the last days, and God can call it to a halt at any moment. In these last days, he says, he has spoken to us in his Son. The word his is not in the original Greek. He has spoken to us in Son. That means Jesus is not only the messenger, he is the message. And when you see Jesus, you are hearing God speak to you. When you see Jesus on the cross, that's God saying something to you. He's saying, I love you this much. I love you. That's the message of God. And he's saying that in the language of his Son. He has spoken to us in Son. Everything that you see about Jesus is God speaking to us. And he says he is appointed heir of all things. All things. Nothing is excluded. That's how important this man Jesus is. Through whom also he, God, made the world. Jesus is the creator of the world. That's kind of hard for us to understand, but that's exactly. He is the Word from God. He is the Word spoken by God. He is the power coming forth from God. He made the world. And he says, he is the radiance of his glory. Who is Jesus? He is the radiance of God's glory. It's sort of like if you look out at the sun today, what you're looking at is primarily the radiance of the sun. And the radiance shows us the brilliance of the sun. But you cannot separate the sun itself from its radiance. Just as you cannot separate Jesus, the S-O-N, from the Father. He is the radiance. When you're looking at the radiance, you're looking at the S-U-N. And when you're looking at Jesus, you're looking at the Father. That's what Jesus said to the disciples in John chapter 14. He's the radiance and he's the exact representation of his nature. If I pulled out of my wallet a picture of my wife, I'd be giving you an exact representation of my wife. Jesus is a picture of the Father. That's what he's saying. And he upholds all things by the word of his power. All of that describes who Jesus is. And then he says, when he had made purification of sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high. Where is Jesus? He's at the right hand of God. He's at the most exalted position in all of the universe. And so all of those questions are asked or answered by the Hebrew letters. So the writer says, you need to fix your eyes on Jesus, who is the author and perfecter of our faith. That word author is an interesting term. It can be translated by the English word source, or originator, or pioneer. But my favorite translation of that word is trailblazer. Because that really captures what the Hebrew writer is saying. Jesus is our trailblazer. In other words, he's the one that has gone ahead of us and he has cleared the trail. He's like Daniel Boone clearing the way through the Cumberland. He has removed all of the obstacles so that we have a clear road to our destination. And Jesus went there first. He blazed the trail for us. And now he's at the end. He's at the goal line. And we need to fix our eyes on Jesus, not being distracted, looking away from to Jesus, not being distracted by all of the trials of this life, so that we take our eyes off of the goal, not being distracted by all of the glitter of this life, all of the prosperity that we have, so that we take our eyes off the goal, but we fix our eyes on Jesus, where he is. And we walk the same trail that he walked. And enter into that eternal promised land that God gave us. He is the trailblazer. Now you see this concept also in chapter 2, where the same word author or trailblazer is used in verse 10. It's the same word in the Greek. He says, for it was fitting for him, that's a reference to God the Father, it was fitting for God, for whom are all things and through whom are all things, in bringing many sons to glory to perfect, that is, to complete the author, that is, the trailblazer of their salvation through suffering. What is it that God is trying to do? He's trying to bring many sons to glory. How did he do it? He first sent a trailblazer to clear the way for us so that we would have a clear path all the way to the ultimate goal that God wants to bring us to. Now look at chapter 6, verses 19 and 20, the last two verses of chapter 6. He talks about the hope that we have. He says, this hope, verse 19, we have as an anchor of the soul, a hope both sure and steadfast, and one which enters within the veil, that is into heaven itself, where Jesus has entered as a forerunner. Now there's that trailblazer concept. A forerunner is someone who ran ahead and someone who cleared the way so that we could negotiate the trail ourselves. Many years ago, since you already know how old I am, when my children were small and my son, who was the baby, was just beginning to learn how to walk, we would put him up in our living room and he would, of course, grab hold of the furniture and he could move around, you know, hanging onto the furniture. And so one day we decided, let's see if we can get him just to walk without all of those crutches. And so we were going to put him on one side of the living room and Mary and I were going to be on the other side of the living room and we were going to call out for him to walk over to us and encourage him to walk without hanging onto the furniture. And so his two older sisters, they got together and they cleared the path for Josh. And they removed all of their dirty clothes, which were scattered everywhere, and all of the toys that they had left out. And they even got together and moved a big chair and an ottoman, just cleared the way so that their little brother could come and walk across the living room. And then they joined us over here with Mom and Dad, and we're all saying, come on, Josh, you can do it. You can do it. And he'd take a few steps, and then he would falter. And those two girls were on him, and they would pick him up, and then they'd run back to Mom and Dad, and we're encouraging, come on. Well, the Hebrew writer says that Jesus is not ashamed to call us brothers. Chapter 2, verses 10 and 11. He's like our older brother. And he went in front of us on the trail that leads to glory. And he removed everything that was a hindrance to us. Whenever I read Hebrews, I'm always mindful of that old television show, Wagon Train. Any of you see Wagon Train? Do you remember that TV show? Oh, I'm glad you did. I'm not old enough. I don't know anything about it. But my folks told me about it. See, I set you up on that one, didn't I? But do you remember how difficult it was from people to, back in the East to come all the way out here to California? It was tough, wasn't it? It was hard. There were difficulties along the way. And you know, some people never completed the trip. It was just too hard. And they just said that we're weary and we're not going any further. And so they settled someplace else. And they never reached their goal. And I see that's where these people are receiving this letter. Life has just gotten too difficult for them. It's tough being a Christian. And so they said, we're not going any further. And sometimes, if you remember those old Wagon Train episodes, I remember one that I saw, or that my folks told me about, that a city slicker came in and he said, hey folks, guess what? There's not really a California out there. There aren't those green lush valleys, and if they got to Ridgecrest, it would have been true, I guess. But all of that stuff is just a pipe dream. You've been deceived about all of that. And so the people would buy into that and they would say, we're not going any further. And apparently that's what's happening, at least for some of these people. Look at chapter 3, because the writer says in verse 12 and 13, he says, take care, brethren, lest there should be in any one of you an evil, unbelieving heart in falling away from the living God, but encourage one another day after day, as long as it is still called today, lest any one of you be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. So some of them are being deceived and they're thinking it can't be done or it's not really there. And so now they have an unbelieving heart and they're quitting. And so the writer is writing all of this to encourage them to keep on keeping on. Now, we understand the trials of life, but there are other obstacles that hinder us from reaching our heavenly goal. There are some obstacles that I call insurmountable. It's sort of like when you became a Christian, you became a pilgrim, and you put on this backpack, and you began a journey towards heaven, didn't you, the day you were baptized. But there's this trail. Did I hear a buzzer? We're in trouble here. There's this trail that we're on towards heaven, but there are big boulders blocking the trail. And these are what I call insurmountable. We can't negotiate them. They're too high to go over, too wide to go around. And so what Jesus did is he broke those boulders into pieces and pushed them to the side so that we would have a clear path all the way to eternity. And I think there are three that are brought out in the book of Hebrews. The first one is death. Death is a problem. You know, the folks coming from the east out here to California, if they died on the journey, they didn't make the goal, did they? They never reached their destination. Death is a problem for humanity. But guess what? Jesus took care of that. In chapter 2, verses 14 through 15, he says, "Since the children," that's us, Christians, "share in flesh and blood," that is, we're humans, "he himself," that's Jesus, "likewise also partook of the same, that through death he might render powerless him who had the power of death," that is, the devil, "and might deliver those who through fear of death were subject to slavery all their lives." The fear of death hinders some people. Did you know if you lived in a time of persecution, they might threaten your life or the life of your wife or your children, and that might get you to compromise? But Jesus took care of the problem of death. We don't have to fear death because of the resurrection. A second boulder in the path was law. Law stood between me and my relationship with God. If I have to stand before God in judgment on the basis of law, I won't make it, and you won't either. Because none of us can keep law perfectly. And so Jesus had to deal with law. Look at chapter 8, where the writer talks about that, verse 6 following. He says, "But now he," that's Jesus, "has obtained a more excellent ministry by as much as he is also the mediator of a better covenant and has been acted on better promises. For if that first covenant had been faultless, there would have been no occasion sought for a second." And I would normally read all of chapter 8, but we're out of time. But Jesus removed the old law. We do not answer to God on the basis of law. And that's good news, isn't it? Because we could never stand before God. So Jesus broke that boulder and pushed the pieces to the side, and we can have a clear path to eternity. And the last boulder that hindered us in reaching our destination and being with God is sin. But look at chapter 9 and hear what Jesus did in regard to sin. In chapter 9, let's begin reading at verse 24. The writer says, "For Christ did not enter a holy place made with hands, a mere copy of the true one, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God for us." What is Jesus doing today? He appears in the presence of God for us. Don't read these passages too quickly or you'll miss what the writer is saying. Can you imagine that we have a man in heaven who has the Father's ear, and he speaks a word into the ear of the Father just for us. Now in verse 25, he says, "Nor was it that he should offer himself often as the high priest," the old high priest, "offers or enters the holy place year by year with blood not his own. Otherwise he would have needed to suffer often since the foundation of the world. But now, once at the consummation of the ages, he has been manifested," he's appeared in other words, "to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself." Jesus has dealt with the sin problem. He put it away. Sin is no longer a boulder that blocks our path to God. The Apostle Paul says, "There is therefore now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus, Romans 8 and verse 1. He's not saying that we'll never sin. He's saying there is no condemnation. Jesus has dealt with the problem of sin. It was like a boulder that hindered us from being in a right relationship with God and reaching our goal of eternity. And he broke that boulder as our trailblazer and he moved it to the side. And so you and I have no insurmountable obstacles keeping us from crossing the goal line. If we will endure, if we will keep on keeping on, and if we'll persevere. But I see a lot of problems with our modern efforts at Christianity. We put on our backpacks and sometimes we come to those places where Jesus has broken those boulders and we tend to pick up little pieces and want to carry them with us in our backpacks. It might be the fear of death with some. It might be making laws that God never made, and we just weigh people down, you know, with our human traditions and laws. Or it might be sin and the burden of guilt that we bear with sin. Some people can't believe in grace. It's just too good to be true. And some people try to move along the trail carrying some of their old sins, and I'll tell you, it'll wear you down. It'll weary you, and you will not complete the trip trying to do that. It seems to me that we ought to lighten the load. That we should recognize that the resurrection of Jesus overcame death. And the resurrection is sort of like a great trail marker.